welcome to another episode of the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and today is August 26, 2008. I want to start tonight's program off with a thank you to all of the listeners who emailed me with comments about last week's panel discussion. I'm always thrilled to read those emails, and I really do pay attention to requests for topics and guests as well. I realized last week that I had announced we'd be having a men's spirituality panel tonight, but the real world has interfered with that minor glitch known as scheduling conflicts. So we had to reschedule that program. It's always a bit tougher when you're trying to get three or four people's schedules to mesh together than when it's just a single guest. So you do have my apologies if you tuned in tonight with high hopes for that program to be live tonight. Right now, before I tell you anything more, I'm going to do all the commercial kind of stuff. You can listen to Paranormal Radio Network simply by calling 704-631-4060 and entering the four-digit station ID code 2899 on UpSnap. To read about tonight's program and upcoming programs, visit exogenynetwork.com. That's spelled exogenynetwork.com. And click on the Dawn of Shades on the left-hand side of the page. While you're there, you can also sign up for the newsletter and the contest. Here in the Dawn of Shades, we do welcome questions, comments, answers, and compliments from our listeners. So, if you want to get up on the mic, you can call in on the toll-free number 1-877-786-0562 or raise your hand in the virtual auditorium. And for tonight's program, I have something that fascinates us all. It's the stuff of fables and fireside tales to sugar over. The stuff of legends like the Honey Island, Swamp Monster, the Loch Ness Monster, and many other local versions. It has a fancy-sounding name, too, cryptozoology. Now, cryptozoology, as a word, takes away the giggle factor that plagues many people who pursue things that mainstream science dares not investigate. Taking a statement directly from a website, www.newanimal.org, here's what they had to say about the topic. Cryptozoology is a study of animals and other creatures that have not been accepted by science as real. In other words, it's monster hunting. Cryptozoologists look for creatures like sea serpents and the Yeti, hoping to gather enough evidence to prove that these beings exist. They also look for more commonplace animals, such as the ivory-billed woodpecker, the giant vampire bat, the inflatable hedgehog, and the pygmy elephant. Creatures that are under investigation by cryptozoologists are called cryptids. Although cryptozoology doesn't get much respect from other scientific disciplines, it has had some spectacular success stories, including the pongo, now known as the gorilla, the okapi, an animal that looks like a cross between a giraffe and a zebra, and I think it's pronounced coelacanth. I'm not even going to swear to that, but it's a prehistoric fish caught to be extinct. Cryptozoologists are a specialized branch of monster hunters since their ultimate goal is to discover either new species of animals or new subspecies. The science of cryptozoology is rooted in biology. The more a creature shows evidence of being supernatural, the less likely it is that cryptozoologists would be interested in it. Now, many cryptozoologists investigate the strangest things like ghostly demon cats, Mothman, or werewolves. Ghost hunts are best left to paranormal investigators and a few fringe cryptozoologists. On the other hand, there are very few animals, however mythical they may be, that have never stirred the interest of cryptozoologists. This is because perfectly real animals have often been obscured by so much folklore that they seem ridiculous. Bernard Hovelmans, the author of the first and most influential book of cryptozoology, On the Track of Unknown Animals, created cryptozoology as a science and separated it from other studies involving anomalies and the paranormal. Early writers in the field were more likely to include mythology and folkloric material, and they used the terms exotic zoology and romantic zoology to describe what they did. Today, there are many organizations devoted to cryptozoology and dozens of books, plus countless individual scientists. Despite this massive amount of interest, most cryptozoologists are underfunded and sink large amounts of their own money into their researches. Now, I found that to be quite interesting, but we should never take just a single source from the Internet as gospel. So back to Google I went. Wikipedia is a user-edited source. It's usually halfway decent about being correct, too. So I thought next I'll try that one. Here's what they had to say, starting off with a brief definition. Cryptozoology is a study of and search for animals which fall outside of contemporary zoological catalogs. It consists of two primary fields of research: the search for living examples of animals taxonomically identified through fossil records but which are believed to be extinct, the search for animals that fall outside of taxonomic records due to lack of empirical evidence but for which anecdotal evidence exists in the form of myths, legends, or undocumented sightings. Those involved in the cryptozoological study are known as cryptozoologists. It also refers to the animals being called cryptids, a term coined by John Wall in 1983. Cryptozoology has seen very little attention from the mainstream scientific community because it does not follow the scientific method in attempts to support its claims. In the overview, Wikipedia added things like that the term had been invented by Bernard Hovelmans, but in his book In the Wake of Sea Serpents, Hovelmans attributes coinage of the term to the late Scottish explorer and adventurer Ivan T. Sanderson. He traces it, the scholarly origins of the discipline way back to 1982 and the Great Sea Serpent, and so forth and so on. So Wikipedia then listed several fairly recent cryptids that were ultimately verified as actual creatures and are scientifically classified now. Any excursion into the realm of cryptozoology via the internet has to include a visit to www.cryptozoology.com as well. I found the site to be very interesting, although it seems to have a lot of less than credible commentary available too. Now, if you're excluding the long list of potential cryptids from your research and focus solely on the humanoid version, commonly known as Bigfoot, the website of authority, in my opinion, is www.bfro.com. The website of the Bigfoot Research Organization, which is also how I came originally into contact with tonight's guest, Matt Pruitt. A lot of people may find that their methods aren't scientific enough to suit some obscure laboratory's methodology. The field research does require first observing your goal, and the hominids seem to be particularly elusive, providing just enough information to keep people like Matt honing their tracking skills and utilizing technology in their attempts to get solid evidence of these creatures and their habits. Unfortunately, many hoaxes have been perpetuated over the years, not only in this field, but in many others as well. Add in the misinterpretation of evidence, whether archaeological or current, and it's no wonder that these investigators seem to be fighting a continual battle. Recently, there was a lot of news coverage of a case in Georgia where two men claimed to have the deceased body of a Bigfoot hidden in their freezer after finding it in the mountains. This in itself sounded a little bit suspicious to me. Next, they send off for a DNA test, which comes back as possum and human. At that point, my personal opinion was that perhaps law enforcement should be investigating as to what the real contents of that freezer really were. I've seen some pretty hairy and unattractive people on occasion, and I wondered, did two overzealous hunters accidentally shoot one of them and then decide that it was Bigfoot? There was still talk about an autopsy, but it wasn't looking too legitimate to anyone at that point. Now, the cat's out of the bag, as this was just one more hoax for whatever motivation, and a lot of jokes have once again taken away the progress of the BFRO and their investigators, so a couple of clowns could have their day in the eye of the news. I'm not a Bigfoot researcher, but tonight's guest is, and he's followed this case much closer and with much more personal interest than I have. Not only is he a Bigfoot researcher himself, but he has recently relocated from the state of Georgia. What better person to get on the Shade to talk about this case, about the damage done by hoaxes, and about real research. So without any more ranting or reading of website information, I'm going to get Matt to introduce himself. Well, Matt, you want to tell everyone a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. Our website URL is actually bfro.net, for anyone who's listening, rather than .com. I'm a field researcher and investigator and expedition organizer for the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization. I've been conducting active Sasquatch field research for quite a while, and recently moved from Georgia to the state of Washington to further pursue these animals out here. The Pacific Northwest is the epicenter of Sasquatch activity, so I wanted to be here for at least a while and learn from people and see some new territory and try some new things. So it's been exciting thus far.
I bet you it has. I bet you it has. So, you know, when I talked to you on the phone a few days ago, you talked about you had followed this case from the beginning. How did you originally
Absolutely.
Hear about it?
Initially, they contacted a friend of mine who had some things on the internet about a case that he investigated, a Sasquatch sighting in Georgia. You know, for the record, there are Sasquatches in North Georgia. I've encountered them myself there, and we've tracked them and been able to gain tangible evidence of them up there. And so my field research started in earnest there. So, of course, you know, I grew up in Northeast Georgia. I've got a pretty strong connection to that area, and especially to the study of these animals in that area. So initially this guy had contacted a friend of mine asking, you know, where this particular case was, because he seemed interested and he said he wanted to know what the range of Bigfoot in the state of Georgia was. So we looked at this guy's username and profile, et cetera, online, and he had this website, BigfootTracker.com, which has now seen so much infamy. And this was mid to late June, so this is quite a while ago. And this website was just preposterous. It had these two guys that claimed to be the greatest Bigfoot trackers in the world, and one of them, Rick Dyer, said that he was a former Army Ranger who had gone AWOL in Kosovo because he had a commanding officer that was trying to make him slaughter innocent women and children. And so he went AWOL and learned how to survive in the forest on his own and brought that skill and knowledge back to the States to hunt Bigfoot. And it was just really ludicrous. I mean, from the outset, we knew that this was pretty ridiculous. Their spelling was awful. Their grammar was just atrocious. The website was a joke. They had pictures up on this website of known hoaxes, like hoaxes that are quite well known in the Bigfoot research community. So it was very obvious to us that these guys had no familiarity with the subject of Bigfoot. And that's kind of how it all started, is this website. And they were offering to take people on these expeditions for $500 into the North Georgia mountains to go look for these animals that they felt might be there. And so no claims of a body, no claims of anything yet. But that was the impetus of this whole thing.
How many legitimate researchers offer to take people on Bigfoot expeditions for a sum of money?
Well, we do that in the BFRO. We have public expeditions that we've held around the country for several years now that we offer to members of the public.
Uh-huh.
In the beginning, some of the very first BFRO expeditions were BFRO members only, and they gained quite a bit of attention, and some very fantastic evidence was pulled out of those expeditions, like the Skookum Cast. The Skookum Cast is one of the three most important pieces of evidence for the existence of these animals that's ever been collected. And so there was an interest from the public. And as you stated earlier, you know, cryptozoology is not very well funded. And so it was an opportunity for us to allow people from the public in and be able to fund research in local areas and have people participate and join the organization. So we did that. And it was very clear to me when I first saw the BigfootTracker.com website that they were emulating that, because they were being very competitive about it, saying, you know, we are the best there is. Don't go out with anybody else. So, and keep in mind, this is the only claim they're making, is that they're, you know, these expert Sasquatch researchers. So I called them at one point, just, you know, almost anonymously, just to pretend to be a potential customer, because I wanted to hear what they would say to me, what they would say to a potential customer.
Uh-huh.
After talking to them for a while, it was just obvious that they had no grasp of this subject. They didn't know anything at all about the history of Sasquatches or what Sasquatches even were. It was just obvious that they thought that they could drum up some scheme to make money, because these guys probably didn't believe in Sasquatches, and they probably still don't. So in the eyes of someone, of guys like Rick Dyer and Matt Whitten, they probably think the idea of looking for Bigfoot is ludicrous. I'm like, it's snipe hunt. And they probably saw that other people were professional Sasquatch researchers, and they thought that they, oh, hey, well, that sounds like a good way to make money. So they tried it, and it didn't work. We basically told them, you know, that it was very clear their motive was transparent, and that, you know, that we knew that they weren't real Sasquatch researchers.
Uh-huh.
So after that, then they started making these claims that, oh, we have clear pictures and video. And, you know, during this time, we started figuring out who these guys were. We were finding out that, you know, the one guy, Rick Dyer, was actually just a used car salesman. He was buying and selling cars on eBay and Craigslist, and that's how he was making money. It wasn't very hard to dig into these guys. The other guy, however, was using an alias, so it was kind of a little bit harder to figure out who he was. Then they started claiming they had clear pictures and video. And so, of course, we challenged and said, you know, it's obvious that you guys don't have anything. If you did have something, you'd demonstrate it. And they said, no, you know, we're waiting for our everything to get set straight with our lawyers. And we knew that wasn't true because most people can say that copyright laws are retroactive in that while they're waiting for the registration to clear, you can still release them on the Internet or in other forms of media, and you're still going to be protected. They're still your photographs. The chain of custody is still there.
Uh-huh.
So we basically said, you know, stop trying to do this. We know you don't have anything. We were hoping they would just go away because they were rather persistent. And then that's when they said later, you know, they'd made some claims that they had some very compelling evidence, and some counterclaims were made to the effect of, you know, what do you guys have, a corpse or something? And it was right after that they said they had a corpse. And so it was obvious to us that, okay, well, these guys don't have anything. But for some reason, that version of their lie really struck with some people. Some people thought, oh, my God, what if this is it? What if these guys really have it? What if the search is over? What if this turns out to be true, and everyone I've tried to convince that these things are real now knows that I'm right? And so this huge avalanche of what-ifs rained down on some people, and they became very empowered by the notion of what if these guys really have a body. Whereas, you know, we in the BFR were trying to say, no, look at the chronology of this lie. Look at the way that they've gone about things. It's obvious that they don't really have anything. Because they claimed that they had a body, that they found a body early June. So our director appeared on Coast to Coast to talk about this and to warn people. And he said, look, you know, these guys don't have anything. People need to not buy into this. If they really had something, it wouldn't play out this way. Because the analogy that the director of the BFRO used was, you know, you wouldn't, if you were on a beach and you stumbled across some, you know, pirate treasure, so to speak, in the sand, you wouldn't unearth it and then run home and go buy some off-the-shelf web developing software and put up a website offering to give 50-cent expeditions of the beach where you found the treasure. It just doesn't make any sense. But unfortunately, people were really believing this version of the lie. This third lie that they had told. And so it gave them power. Now people are saying, you know, well, we'll do whatever it takes to help you out. We'll do whatever it takes to help you get this body in the right hands. So no one's challenging them anymore because they kept playing this game where they were basically saying, okay, well, you know, if you want to see this body, you've got to help us out. And if you become a naysayer at all, we'll cut you out of our deal. So all of a sudden, people in the Bigfoot research community empowered them. So we kept trying to dismiss it, and then something really interesting happened. I was at home out here in Seattle now, and a friend of mine called me and said, you're never going to believe this. You need to find some Atlanta local news media. So I went online and went to some news affiliates in Atlanta, and here was this guy who called himself Gary Parker. His real name is Matthew Whitten, and he's a police officer, and he's been shot in the line of duty. You know, during the middle of him trying to create these YouTube videos and this website, he's lying to all these people saying he has the body of a Sasquatch. We didn't know what he did for a living. When we saw that, we thought, oh, my goodness, this guy's actually a police officer. You know, he's a Clayton County Sheriff's Deputy, of all things. It was really mind-boggling at that point because we still knew we didn't have it. But our worst fears came true is that people would believe them even more now. And so people start saying, well, of course they must have it because he's a cop. Why would a cop risk his career? Why would a cop lie about something like this? And every turn of the that they made, we had a counteraction. You know, we were trying to just get them stopped to go away, and we thought that these releasing of this information would really help. The next thing they did after he was shot was that they filmed a video of a guy flying in from Texas, this Dr. Paul Van Buren, who's a pathologist who specializes in primate morphology, to come examine their body. And in this video, he meets with them at the airport, and then he goes to their place of residence, and he examines the body off camera, and then comes back on camera saying, you know, this is unlike anything I've ever seen. It doesn't fit into any taxonomic classification that I know of. Well, it was obvious right away that this guy was not who he said he was. And so right the same night that that video came out, I was able to through some kind of cyber sleuthing method, figure out that he was actually the police officer's brother, Martin, who was just an amateur photographer from Texas. And so I thought, okay, we've got him now. We can prove that this guy is actually just his brother, Martin. He's not a doctor. And so here's this police officer, you know, fraudulently showing this supposed PhD, because the way you have to piece all this together is that they're still, during this whole time, they're still selling these expeditions, or trying to, on their website, saying that for $500, we'll take you to where we found the body. Well, if there's no body, then that's a crime. So if they're lying about having found a body, and they're lying about this PhD examining it and identifying it, and yet they're taking money from people to go to these places and see it, then that's more than just a hoax. That's a crime. That's fraudulent. So I thought this would certainly shut them down. Once we proved and put on the net, you know, we had family portraits of these guys, the two brothers together, you know, the PhD, so to speak. We really thought that would stop them, that they would just finally go away, and they would be so afraid of the legal ramifications.
The doctor that he claimed that his brother was, or that his brother was portraying, does he really exist?
No.
No, okay.
No, not at all. Had he existed, it would have been harder to track down, but it was very easy to figure out that there was no such Paul Van Buren. What was difficult was to figure out who the guy in the video was. So we immediately, the BFRO released this saying, look, here's proof they're lying, you know, this is not true, et cetera, et cetera. Then they put out another ridiculous video saying, okay, well, yeah, you got us, but we actually do still have the body. And we thought, there's no way anyone's going to believe this now, but they did. And that's when things took a turn for the worse, and, you know, known hoaxer Tom Biscardi became involved, and he kind of spearheaded this small scam and turned it into a very large scam. He immediately had them, you know, lining up press conferences, and they had that press conference, and it was a very trying situation to go through, because we had been shouting from day one, you know, for people not to believe this, but it kept snowballing. The next big mistake they made was putting out a picture of this supposed corpse in the freezer. And within 5 minutes of that picture hitting the internet, all I had to do, I did a Google image search for the word Bigfoot mask, and I found a match within, you know, 5 minutes. And we had it up on the BFRO site immediately. We said, this is a costume. Click here to see the costume that they used to fake this with. And it's a mail order costume from the internet. I called the manufacturer of the costume. Unfortunately, he was en route to a trade expo, and I was trying to get him, you know, in front of a screen and say, look, you know, you need to look at this picture and see if you can verify that this is your product, because your costume is about to be used in a nationwide media hoax. And he said he'd look at it, and sure enough, he went on coast to coast and said, yeah, that's my suit. I recognize that suit. So I did my best, myself and our director and other people in the BFRO, to contact media affiliates there in San Francisco, NBC, ABC, CBS, and tell them. We gave them all this information, saying, look, you know, please don't go to this press conference. Please don't put them on the air. You're just going to give these guys a venue and a platform for their lies. And it's obviously, at this point, a lie. There's no way, you know, that there's any shred of truth to any of this. But somehow they still garnered enough attention to where, you know, it was live on Fox News, it was live on CNN. It was just kind of a disastrous thing that it all happened. But I felt glad that, from what I could tell, I missed all that because I was out here in the field on an expedition, you know, actually in the field looking for Sasquatches instead of watching this on TV. But from what I understand, the media was very harsh to them, and no one really bought this too much. I think the main damage that was done was the fact that Fox News and CNN, before the press conference, the press conference was on Friday, and the story actually broke that Wednesday, that previous Wednesday. So there were these headlines being circulated saying, you know, Bigfoot body discovered in Northeast Georgia. So, of course, that I got the same response as if it had said, you know, Matt Pruitt wins the lottery. All these people are calling me to say congratulations, and I'm having to tell them, no, it's not true. It's a lie. None of this is true. Because people are saying, oh, man, you were right. There really are Sasquatches, and they really are in North Georgia, you know. So it was very, at that point, it was kind of a personal thing.
I heard about it, the first thing I thought is, oh, I need to give Matt Pruitt a call, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I didn't realize you'd relocated, and therefore, you know, even if your name wasn't associated, you know, with the news reports, I figured you were surely aware of it.
Oh, absolutely. Myself and another BFR member and the director of the BFR, we were the three people closest to this case, absolutely, within our organization. I mean, this was an all-day, everyday thing because we were trying to avoid exactly what happened. And it's funny because on Monday, the Monday after the press conference is when the story broke that it was a costume, even though we were saying the previous Monday that it was a costume, we were showing which costume it was, you know? So it was actually the previous Tuesday that we were showing. So, you know, predating it by almost a week, we were saying, this is not real. It's a costume. Here's the costume that they used. Here's how they did it. I'm glad it's over now, obviously, but it was just such a, to start off from this ridiculous little website and these YouTube videos to, you know, these guys had the national press conference. They had this kind of almost worldwide attention. I mean, this is 10 times bigger than the previous biggest Sasquatch story in the media in terms of how many news outlets picked it up and how much coverage it got. I mean, this is easily the biggest Bigfoot story the media has ever seen. And it's unfortunate that it was this story. But,
the hoax is like this? Have a positive influence on serious research or a negative one?
To tell you the truth, I really don't think that this has given the subject a black eye. And I've thought a lot about this because people always say, oh, it's over, man. You know, the subject's been given a black eye. No one's gonna take this seriously. I don't agree with that. The burden of proof still falls on us, and it fell on us before this happened. The standard of evidence is the same, you know. Blurry pictures and video now are still not going to be as good as they were before then. You know, they're not, people say, oh, well, you won't be able to get anything through the door. Well, you couldn't get anything through the door before this. I mean, it's going to take incredible amounts of footage, very compelling footage, DNA evidence, or a body. That has a chance. So, in terms of what's required of us as researchers, the standard of proof is exactly the same as it was, standard of evidence. I think people who believe the Sasquatches are real animals, their belief has not been swayed by this hoax, you know, and certainly non-believers haven't changed their minds either. I really don't think that this will affect the subject negatively. Sasquatches, you know, are, in my opinion, they are real, living, breathing animals. And so people will continue to see them. They will continue to report about them. They'll continue to find their tracks and have encounters. This has in no way, it has not invalidated the evidence, you know, of the past 50 years that's been scrutinized by science. It doesn't invalidate the work of people like Dr. Jeff Meldrum or Dr. Grover Krantz or the BFRO. It hasn't invalidated any of that. It was just a couple of guys who got a heck of a lot of attention over you know, a failed attempt to generate some money. And they did make a small bit of money. I mean, they made about $50,000, which is, that's been the media story now, is do they deserve to be sued? Can they pay it back, et cetera? But that's all it was. It was just a couple of guys who weren't very bright. You know, the police officer lost his job over this, and he deserved to, by the way. This doesn't invalidate the subject. It doesn't invalidate myself or any other researcher. We've still got the same task. It's not going to be any easier, but it's not going to be any more difficult now either. I mean, I think that the Bigfoot community will remain unscathed. What will happen is people will be very dubious and wary of informant claims like this. You know, if you claimed you had a body, the easiest thing in the world would be to demonstrate it. You know, if someone claims they've seen one, well, that's a very difficult thing to demonstrate. But if you claim that you actually have one in your physical possession, then it should not be very hard to demonstrate that. So I think what people will be wary of are individuals who try to attach themselves to large claims like that, especially seeking any kind of major attention or large amounts of money. That's what people should be worried about.
Right, yeah. And people should pay attention to whether or not something is true. And that's everywhere, not just in Bigfoot research. There are scam artists out there with everything under the sun and some things
Absolutely.
I never thought of, you know? Lots of things I've never thought of. It did kind of amuse me that when they sent in the stuff that they collected for the DNA testing, that it came back possum and human. I'm thinking, you know, were they really so stupid to think that they could fool a DNA test?
Well, then what they tried to say was that because it's a human-like creature and it must have been eating possum. But they admitted that they stuffed the costume full of roadkill, like possum roadkill and slaughterhouse guts, and they probably cut off some of their own hair for the, you know, the human portion. I mean, who knows what they did, but nothing that they did was clever. I mean, again, they tried to fool everyone with these lies that were just, you know, the lie of the brother was easy to solve. The costume, again, that was something that anyone could Google image search and have the answer to in 5 minutes. I mean, how long did they expect to fool people for? It was just really, it was ludicrous. It was such a sensational thing. The story had two compelling components. Number one, it was such an outrageous claim to make that people thought, well, there must be something to it, because why would they say they have it if they don't really have it? Because that's a lie with a time limit on it. You can't say that you have it forever.
Right.
And number two, the guy was a police officer who had been injured in the line of duty, and so they thought that automatically made him, immune to any kind of greed. Like that this guy was, oh, he's obviously the most honest man who ever walked the earth. Well, it was obvious to us that that wasn't the case. These guys were lying. These guys were trying to they somehow must have thought that if they got a lot of attention, that it would somehow equate to making a lot of money. And so I think the reason they got that attention is because the guy was a cop and it was an outrageous claim. And people thought, well, certainly they have something to show for such an outrageous claim, but they didn't.
Now, you know, I know there have been other hoaxes in the Bigfoot research field. What other kinds of hoaxes have there been?
Well,
they usually don't get to go this far. You know,
most
of the time they don't make it beyond the local news.
Well, most people who, I mean, there have been stories of kids wearing gorilla suits who run across the road, you know, in front of cars and motorists and try to scare them. And there have been the occasional faked track, faked photograph or video. But nothing like this where, I mean, because the people that fake the tracks and the photos and the videos, they usually don't try to make any money, and they usually don't try to get a whole heck of a lot of attention. These guys said in that press conference that they wanted to make as much money as they could from this, you know.
Well, they were saying that
from the standpoint, you know, they're still in character pretending they have a body, but they meant that when they said that. They intended to make a lot of money from this. And like I said, the two guys, the two Georgians, they made $50,000 from it.
Uh-huh.
So...
Well, Matt, we do have a question in the virtual auditorium.
Okay.
So, Dimensional Star, if you'll give your first name and your location, you are live and on the air with Matt Pruitt.
Hello, Matt. My name is November. I live in Oregon. The last big media event that I can recall, aside from this fiasco that these gentlemen put on, was there was a sighting reported by a psychologist and his family near the Oregon caves. Having been there myself and hearing some of the stories long before he had ever been there, just from various merchants and not, about Bigfoot sightings, did anybody from your organization investigate that particular sighting, and what was the conclusion?
And yes, there were BFRO people who came. If I'm not mistaken, and I wasn't in this part of the country at that time, if I'm not mistaken, I believe that the BFRO were some of the first people that he reported his sighting to. And now the BFRO thinks that that's, you know, definitely a legitimate sighting. We think that, that definitely happened. I mean, his story is so compelling. First of all, you know, he's a man of strong character, a very credible person, and a compelling story. And it kind of sparked something into him. He became very passionate about Bigfoot research, and I believe he still conducts active field research to some degree. But he was so... He had a very kind of traumatic encounter. The animal didn't really threaten him in any way. It didn't chase him or growl at him or scream at him, but it scared him to be close to it, to see the size of this thing, and, you know, just to realize that these things were actually out there. So it really left... He felt that he had post-traumatic stress disorder after that incident, but he used that and fueled it and was able to bring himself back out in the field in pursuit of these things. So it's a very powerful sighting, and it's like I said, I think that that's a very legit report, a legitimate encounter, and that one did get quite a lot of media attention because of who he was. In the same way that this got a lot of attention because this gentleman was a cop, well, this Oregon cave sighting got a lot of media attention because he was a psychologist. You know, he's someone who knows the boundaries, so to speak. And so when he says, "I saw this animal, I observed it, and I'm not crazy," you know, it's pretty compelling.
Just out of curiosity, could you sort of give us an example of what a classic or generic sighting might be like?
To be honest, most sightings, I mean, people always remember the really, really scary ones first, because those are the most memorable and people really attach to those. And there's a lot of very endearing and kind of interesting sightings too. But the vast majority of sightings usually are person sees Sasquatch, Sasquatch sees person, and they both go in opposite directions as quickly as they can. I mean, that's how most sightings play out. Either the Sasquatch will freeze and hide, or it will leave. There are occasions where they do other things, and again, those are the ones that people tend to remember the most, are the very menacing ones, but most sightings are either of a Sasquatch. Oftentimes they'll cross roads in front of vehicles. People get a very clear view of them in those instances because the Sasquatch is leaving the wood line. It's exposing itself. It comes fully out into the open, and oftentimes it's at night, so they become illuminated by the headlights of the vehicle. That's a very common sighting, but mostly, you know, is Sasquatch and a person observe each other for a brief moment, and then they both decide to leave the area. That's the average sighting.
Yeah, just out of curiosity, too, I grew up in along the Iowa-Minnesota border. There's not a lot of woodland there, you know, like groves by farms, you know, small clusters of trees, not a lot of cover for any hominid of any sort, big, little, or whatever kind. And at the same time, I don't know what I saw that night, but as a teenager one night, I was driving home. It was late, and I was past curfew, so, you know, anybody who's remembers being 16, 17 years old, being past curfew, I was sweating it already. I was about 5-6 miles out of town. There was a railroad crossing across the road. I swore that I saw Bigfoot run across the road in front of me. I hit my brakes. I went into a skid. I wrecked the car. Okay? You know, I don't know where Bigfoot went. I wasn't really worried about Bigfoot anymore after the accident. You know, would Bigfoot have been there? Was I hallucinating? What the heck did I see that night?
Well, I remember we actually talked about this before, and it was near some railroad tracks.
Right, right.
You know, oftentimes, and I think we talked before, that they'll use those railroad tracks as travel ways, as many animals will.
Uh-huh.
You know, deer
right.
and other animals are funneled through there. I would have to see the area. What I would recommend, like I said, we have a nationwide sightings database on our website that goes by state and then by county. And I would just see if there's other sightings from that county or from surrounding counties in those areas. There may be, you know, a lot of corroboration.
It's been a day or two since I was a teenager, and, you know, the area has changed. I was recently in the same area. I wouldn't have even recognized it. I couldn't find familiar. I was driving through there with my daughter. I'd been, you know, back in the area to visit family, and I was trying to show her some things from, you know, when I was a teenager. I couldn't even find them. You know, they're gone.
What
you know, things
county?
Have changed there a lot. Pardon?
What was the county? State of the county?
Osceola County, Iowa. Osceola County, and it was in the 70s.
Well, there are, on our website at least, a total of 36 reports published from Iowa. And again, with our website, our process is such that people submit reports through our online submission form, and then local investigators in the state where the report comes in will, an investigator will assign the report to himself, him or herself, and look into it. And
mm-hmm.
they don't get published on our website unless they've been thoroughly looked into. And unless they, you know, the investigator feels that this is a legitimate sighting. So when I say that there's 36 in the state of Iowa, that's certainly not all the Bigfoot reports or encounters that have ever happened there. I mean, there's obviously going to be much more than that. Most sightings or encounters never get reported. And
obviously.
The ones that do get reported, they usually get reported to family or friends. They, you know, it's a huge process until it comes to us. And then once it comes to us, we look through it. And there's a lot of great sightings in our internal database that we won't publish. You know, oftentimes, I mean, we're very respectful of witness anonymity, and very often witnesses report things to us, and they just ask us, you know, please don't ever publish this. Even if it's totally anonymous, they don't want that account to be out there. So, you know, there are always more reports in actuality than the ones you'll find in a book or on a website. But that's just something to keep in mind.
Another story that is commonly been told, you know, I heard it many times when I was young, is that Bigfoot is particularly threatening to women. I have no idea why, but supposedly it was more likely to attack or try to steal the women or whatever the heck it was doing, try to bash its way into log cabins and so forth and so on. You know, is there anything, you know, in recent history that hasn't much credibility more than these legend-like stories that indicates that women are at more risk from Bigfoot?
No. I mean, we actually think that they're less threatened by women. And we have done that on expeditions many times. And we think it actually works, and that we'll get groups of women together to go out and feel the dark and to talk loudly and laugh. And oftentimes, I know some of the women out here in Washington in the BFRO will sing songs, oftentimes just Christmas carols or children's songs they know all the words to.
Uh-huh.
And we think that Sasquatches can perceive that they are women and not men, you know, obviously by their stature and their voices. And they're probably much less threatened by them because of the way women generally behave in nature. It's very different, you know. Men in nature, a lot of the people that you would observe in nature are hunters, and the majority of those are men.
Men react to fear
very differently. Well, when men have fear reactions, oftentimes they scream or shout or shoot or shine lights or throw things, and women don't react that way to, you know, something big skulking in the brush, so to speak. So, and that's not to speak for all men or all women, obviously, but those kind of things are unfounded. I mean, first of all, Sasquatch don't go around, you know, bashing in log cabins to get at anyone. And if they did, we would know about it because we would know more about Sasquatches. If those animals had the potential, the propensity, rather, to display that behavior, then they would have gotten themselves caught by now. I mean, a good example would be this. Our director pointed this out to me recently, too, is that people discuss, like an animal like the great white shark, a lot of people know about that animal. And how do we know about it? We know about them in the context of them attacking and killing people, killing us humans. So it's compelling to us. It's interesting. Same with bears and cougars and all these animals you hear about, these animal attacks. And these animals like bears and cougars in many places were hunted to near extinction because of the threat that they pose to humans. Well, Sasquatches don't do that. They've evolved and adapted a lifestyle to avoid confrontation with humans, almost at all costs. Now, they will confront people and they will approach people and observe people, but, you know, for the vast majority, the most part, they don't. You know, they have a lifestyle that is completely about the avoidance of confrontation with humankind. So, you know, there's people talk about, are they dangerous? Do they attack people? You know, if they did, we'd know a lot more about them. We'd know that they were there. They would be in our encyclopedias by now if they had a habit of going after people.
Okay. Well, you know, I kind of wondered because I have this tendency to go camping with just myself and the dog. And, you know, now I live in Louisiana, but, you know, I don't camp just in Louisiana. You know, I'll go to Florida and Mississippi and whatnot. And all these areas also have stories about things ranging from the Honey Island Swamp Monster to actual Bigfoot. And whether the Honey Island Swamp Monster is a Bigfoot or some green moss-covered thing, I don't know. I've not ever seen the Honey Island Swamp Monster. And from the stories that I've heard, I don't think I'd want to. It's supposed to be fairly terrifying. But, you know, stories like that get perpetuated. So I wondered, you know, are women more at risk? And I'm glad you said no, you didn't think so. Because
having a dog helps, too, because dogs would be one of the better Sasquatch deterrents. Dogs kind of represent an early warning system in all societies, even primitive societies. Friends of mine that traveled to, you know, I have a friend who's traveled extensively in Sri Lanka that said, you know, there's a dog in every one of those, you know, family households that barks when someone comes around. And it's always been that way. And dogs kind of serve that for us. And animals know that, especially very intelligent animals like Sasquatches. They don't want the humans to know they're there. And if you're out there by yourself with no dog, they'll probably get pretty close and get a pretty good look at you, and you'd never know it. But, you know, because we can't hear very well, we can't smell them very well, we can't see in the dark. Even if we could, we can't go chasing after them, and we certainly couldn't catch up to them. You know, they're very safe around us. Well, dogs are immune to all that. I mean, dogs can smell them, they can see them, they can hear them, they can alert us to Sasquatches. They could chase a Sasquatch if they wanted to. They could bite it.
That's why I have the dog that goes camping with me, is because she does see better, smell better, hear better.
Absolutely. And Sasquatches will keep a much greater distance in the forest from people with dogs. They do not like dogs. There are many reports of them reacting violently to dogs, things like this. And it's you know, they don't seek out dogs and attack dogs, no, but very often dogs turn and chase after them, and that's when the violent reactions occur. People often say to me, you know, why would a Sasquatch be afraid of a dog? It's so much larger. Well, you know, I've seen grown people jump on a countertop if there's a mouse in the kitchen. So the size thing isn't a factor. The factor is that you know, dogs can chase Sasquatches through the woods in the dark and bite them and cause them harm, and the Sasquatches don't want the humans to be alerted, so it's almost like you'd have to think if you were some kind of undercover operative, like a ranger or a commando or special forces, if you're approaching to observe someone, you're going to keep a much wider perimeter if they have a dog. You're not going to come nearly as close because now not only do you have the human's very limited field of detection abilities, but now you have the dog's vast field of detection. So, you're probably doing, if you're going camping alone with the dog, you're probably pretty safe.
Yeah, well, like I said, that's the reason she goes camping with me. And it's not because I go through life afraid of attacks by Bigfoot. you know, it's usually human foot that you need to worry much more about.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they're, we're far worse than Bigfoot has ever been.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so, yeah, I was very, very curious about that. But, folks, guess what? It is time for us to take a break. It's also a very good time to visit my website, exogenynetwork.com, where you can find all sorts of interesting bits of information, from recipes to shopping to past guests and future events. While you're there, sign up for the newsletter and contest. And if you want to listen to this program on the go, you can do so by calling UpSnap at 704-631-4060 and entering the four-digit station ID code 2899. So in the meantime, do stay tuned to the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, and the Dawn of Shades will be right back with our guest, Matt Pruitt. Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and we are talking tonight with Matt Pruitt about the good, the bad, the and the ugly with Bigfoot research. Once again, I would like to invite everyone to sign up for the newsletter at exogenynetwork.com so that you get the latest and greatest information on everything from upcoming shows to new blog postings. Ladies, there's also a picture and a biography for Matt posted on the website. It's a great outdoor shot of a very good-looking man, so you really do need to go take a look at him. It's not every day that we feature a handsome man as a guest. So, Matt, while we were on break, people in the virtual auditorium were curious about why Bigfoot doesn't wear clothes.
Well, Sasquatch is, I mean, the main reason they don't wear clothes is because they're not people, they're not human, but moreover, I mean, they're devoid of those things because they don't need them. They don't use sophisticated tools. I mean, the extent of their tool use would be very primitive, let's say, like rocks and sticks. But they don't need to construct shelters, and they don't need to create clothing because they don't need those things. They have no use for them. Their bodies are very large and generate a lot of body heat and keep them warm. They're covered in hair, which keeps them warm, and so you know, all these things that apply to humans don't really apply to them. So an interesting thing about them is they are very, very intelligent as early humans. But whereas humans use their intelligence to figure these things out and to create tools and clothing and shelter and fire, Sasquatches haven't needed to do that. So they use their intelligence in other ways, you know, in terms of strategy and evasiveness. So it's a very kind of interesting to see that same intelligence manifested differently, but the reason they don't need the clothing is basically just it's not something that they physically require whatsoever.
That's a very logical explanation. Now, in the virtual auditorium, we do have another question from an audience member. So, CDA 7420. If you come up to the mic, state your first name and your location, and you're live and on the air with Matt Pruitt.
Hi, this is Don. I don't know if you can hear me or not. Sometimes this works, sometimes it don't. I camp a lot in northwest Florida around Milton, Pensacola area. I'm just wondering if there have been sightings in that area. I've been camping there for a long time, and I know there's bears and there's wildcats and what you would call a cougar, but I've never seen one, so does that mean they're not there?
Pensacola, Milton area is what
he said. There are many sightings in that area of Florida. I don't know specifically around Pensacola or not, but I know the panhandle, especially around the Georgia, Alabama, Florida border. But there's quite a lot, and they go back hundreds of years. I mean, they go back to, you know, early Native American times as well. So I would recommend looking on our website, just in the state of Florida at those counties, those corresponding counties. You'll probably see some modern day reports, but there's enough food produced there to have a population of black bears and to have populations. I mean, there's small populations of cougars. I know they're out there. In fact, some states, most states east of South Dakota don't even recognize the cougar as part of the local fauna, but I know that they're out there. They just live in very low numbers. But again, if an area produces enough food to support those populations, then Sasquatches would, you know, they could be supported there too. And if they're in that area, they wouldn't ignore places like that. So I would definitely look into it. But there are some good, our database online should give you a good starting point.
You know, in the virtual auditorium, there's been a lot of comments about, you know, if you haven't seen it, therefore, you know, it surely can't exist. But I know from personal experience, I was in northern Minnesota for 2 weeks with the intention of seeing a moose. I went to locations where there's supposed to always be moose, and I never saw a moose. Well, using that criteria, that means moose don't exist.
Well,
you know,
people
I know
have
they
buried...
exist, but, you know, the thing is that, you know, even when you go to a place where a creature is living, a species is living, and it's well documented that they are living there, and you're there specifically to see them, you may not see them, you know?
Absolutely. People have very unrealistic expectations when it comes to stuff like that. And beyond that, people just don't understand the logistics of a lot of these things. For example, in northeast Georgia, my former study area, the average, I operated in a national forest area that was 866,000 acres of national forest. There is a black bear population that averaged, now it doesn't mean there is one per every mile, but the average population of bears versus landmass was one bear per square mile of national forest. And I walked many, many, many miles of that forest for many years, and I've seen bears cross the road, but let's exclude those, you know. And I've seen one bear in the field out conducting research, and I'm going in the most remote areas, and I'm going in the darkest corners of these forests where people don't travel, and I saw one bear. Now, there's probably 200 bears for every Sasquatch in the state of Georgia, so, you know, the odds of actually seeing one, and people need to understand they're very, very rare animals. They don't, you know, there are fewer Sasquatches than there are of any other animal in the continent, most likely, any other mammal, anyway. That's not to say that they're endangered. They're certainly not endangered.
Has anyone sat down and figured out how many would be required for a viable population?
In the continent, the lowest would be about 2,000. 2,000 individuals on the continent, which, you know, we think that there are 2,000 to 6,000 of them in the Pacific Northwest alone.
Oh.
Not only, I mean, there are, I'll tell you this, there are a lot more of them than people think. I mean, we will never know, though. That's the thing. We will never know how many of them there are. Getting a census of their population will be next to impossible. Even when they're discovered to be real and they're taxonomically classified and we know that they're real living animals, we'll never know how many of them there are. It's just going to be too difficult because they're very, very, they're the hardest animal on the continent to locate, first of all. Beyond that, they're extremely difficult to follow. They're nearly impossible to follow. They're nearly impossible to subdue. So keeping tabs on them that way would be hard. What you'd have to do to figure that out you'd have to figure out some kind of ratio like you do with bears in Georgia. I mean, that's only one part of Georgia, they say. In the Chattahoochee National Forest, their bear population averages out to one bear per square mile of forest. They may be able to do some kind of rough estimation like that one day, decades from now. I mean, even if we prove that Sasquatches exist tonight, decades from now we won't know how many of them there are. We think that there are, I mean, roughly, I don't even want to throw out a number here, but You know, the most conservative estimate I've heard would be 2,000 to 6,000 on the North American continent, which is pretty good. I think there's more than that, but not a tremendous amount more. But I mean, it's so speculative to talk about population density. Let's just say that they're very, very rare. They don't occur everywhere. They don't occur. You know, there are Sasquatches in the state of Georgia, but they don't live in every corner of the forest in Georgia. They don't live in every state park. They don't live in every national forest. They don't live in every watershed, and they don't live in every county. I mean, they're very rare.
Now, how much physical evidence has been collected?
What's that?
How much physical evidence has been collected? You know, we've heard about, you know, footprints being collected, like, you know, it's like, why don't they conveniently leave a clump of hair on a twig or, you know, a thorn?
They left hair behind. We've collected hair. The BFRO has collected hair samples. And I mean, there's a wealth of footprints that have been cast and photographed. That's the most tangible and the greatest abundance of physical evidence. There are good video.
Now, has the hair ever been DNA tested?
There's DNA testing and there's morphology testing. Now, to get DNA out of things is not as easy as everyone thinks it is, especially when it comes to an aged sample. So the most common testing that's been done is morphology testing. And the hairs that have been collected that are verified, you know, presumptive Sasquatch samples, are primate in origin. They don't correlate to any other known primate, and they're not human, but they all correlate to each other, these different samples. But there was a sample of hair and skin tissue, muscle tissue, and fatty tissue that was obtained in Ontario a couple of years ago that, for all intents and purposes, is Sasquatch DNA. Now, until we have a huge amount of Sasquatch DNA, like a body, to compare it against, we can't say definitively it is. But there was this case in Ontario, Snell Grove Lake. It was well documented on the television show Monster Quest. Dr. Jeff Meldrum and Dr. Kurt Nelson were involved. And, I mean, it's a very long story to go into, but, you know, if you search for the results of the Snell Grove Lake DNA, you find out. But basically, this piece of tissue was collected. It was very remote. The circumstances, extenuating circumstances, seemed to point to the fact that it was a very large animal, basically either a bear or a Sasquatch. And when the DNA was tested, it was very peculiar. It was not bear, and it was very close to humans. In fact, closer to humans than chimpanzee DNA. But it was still, it had one genome pair different than humans. Whereas chimps have a difference of about 35 base pairs that makes them different. This was not entirely human. It had one base pair different, which meant that it had about a 1 in 5,000 chance that it was human. And people think, well, then it must be human. Well, if you saw the extenuating circumstances of how this piece of tissue was obtained, you'd soon realize that it was not human tissue. But so, I mean, there are those things being collected. You know, we have hundreds and hundreds of footprints. There are many, many hair samples that have been collected over the decades across the continent. There's images. There's amazing audio recordings. You know, there's fantastic pieces of footage like the Patterson-Gimlin film, which has never been debunked. Which, by the way, I met Bob Gimlin in June, and that was amazing. And then we have this new DNA evidence that came out of Snell Grove Lake, Ontario. So we're closing the gap, but it's happening very slowly. I mean, the information's coming at a faster rate now that there are more of us and we have more of an understanding of what we're up against, but it's not going to be any easier. But you'll see, you know, we'll continue to collect these things, and I'm sure before this year is out, there will be new discoveries made. There are every year, and so hopefully, you know, more DNA, more hair, more footage, et cetera.
Now, you know, I, as part of the research, you know, you try to understand their habits and whatnot. What do you know about the Bigfoot diet?
We know that they're generalized omnivores. The same way, in a lot of the same respects as bears are, in a lot of the same respects as early humans were. They seem to be opportunistic carnivores. We've found evidence of their predation on certain animals, especially whatever the dominant ungulate species in the area is. We've seen quite a lot of that. In the southeast, it's usually white-tailed deer. Out here out west, it's elk and black-tailed deer that they'll predate, they'll prey upon. We've seen evidence of them taking various types of vegetation. There are lots and lots of reports of them eating all kinds of things. We've had reports of them getting into rural agriculture, taking chickens, goats, young cows, calves, things like this, even getting into trash cans, dumpsters, etc. So they're very opportunistic, much like a bear is. But, I mean, they're generalized omnivores. They could eat, you know, opportunistically whatever flora and fauna are in the environment around them.
Now, have their samples of, say, nests or tools been collected that originate probably from Bigfoot?
There have been some alleged nests that have been studied that are very interesting. They're similar in some ways to bedding sites created by other primates like gorillas and chimpanzees. But they don't seem to do that very often. I mean, they don't seem to have any kind of permanency in where they stay, even if it's only for a few days. They really have developed a lifestyle that's devoid of leaving behind those kind of signs. They're very good and very adaptive to not leaving behind any indicator of their presence. And that's the thing with tools. We know they don't use tools because if they did, we would find them because they would be leaving them around. They wouldn't be able to scoop them all up and to hide them all or to carry them all with them all the time. But they don't have those things because they don't need them. They have very powerful physiques and very powerful hands. Everything that they need is literally at their fingertips. Their lifestyles rely on these eternal things that are in the environment around them. And they are able to access all these things because of their great size and strength. They don't really need tools to access any of these things. They're really perfect for their lifestyle.
Most of us have seen video footage of deer and elk and whatnot being killed by wolves and bears and whatnot. Has anyone speculated on how they would kill?
Very oftentimes when we find deer killed or elk killed, the neck is almost always broken, and very often the leg or sometimes multiple legs are broken and twisted. Usually the stomach is torn open and the softer organs are taken, most notably the liver. We think that they use this as a supplement to their diet. You know, it's something that's been talked about for quite a while, and I think the BFRO, specifically our director, Matt Moneymaker, was first person that I think to really hone in on the ungulate predation. The liver is a very important organ, especially as an organ to be harvested. There's a great article on our website about the connection between Sasquatch and deer populations and these deer kills. But to be specific, I've got it right here. But, you know, deer liver contains substantial amounts of every vitamin necessary for life. Okay, and that really comes into play when you look at the lifestyle of a big animal during really difficult months like the fall and the winter. Things, vitamins that would be depleted from their system that they would get out of vegetation, now they have access to in large amounts in these deer livers. Vitamin A, for example, is very crucial for animals' ability to see in the dark. So a big, large, nocturnal animal like a Sasquatch would be really attracted to this kind of thing. So that we think that that's what they're doing. And we've seen this enough around the continent now to really be able to kind of pin it down and say, yeah, but, you know, this is important. This is an important thing to pay attention to. Because witnesses will find these kind of stashes of bodies of deer carcasses or elk carcasses, and they're killed in a very unusual way. And they have no... There's no bite marks on these bodies. There's no claw marks. There are no bullet wounds. There's no blunt force trauma. There's nothing to indicate that any normal thing did this. But yet they happen in hotbeds of Sasquatch activity and similarly across the continent. So there have been a few reports of people claiming to watch these things hunt and, you know, actually physically grab these animals or to trained relays and run the animals towards each other and catch them. But again, that's another thing. If we proved that Sasquatches exist tomorrow, if we were tasked with the, you know, an assignment to go film them hunt, I mean, that could take decades. So again, these are all things that we're just now learning about and just now putting the connections together in the last 10 years and trying to figure out how this all works together. And so a lot of it's speculative, but it's based on really solid, kind of groundbreaking evidence. But still, it's going to be a very long time before we know everything there is to know about these animals.
Now, you know, having a little bit of familiarity with their physical abilities, what do you think the chances are of putting a radio collar on one and releasing it?
Impossible. First, you'd have to catch it.
Oh, yeah. Assuming that you had one, that you could catch one, do you think you could get a collar on them and keep it on them?
No. They have opposable thumbs, and they're incredibly strong. So they would. There's nothing that would be strong enough to stay on the animal. I mean, these things are so... If you do any research and study the strength, kind of upper limits of orangutans, chimps, and gorillas, you will be amazed at how physically strong those animals are. I mean, it's beyond superhuman. And then you take that kind of bone density and muscle structure and body mass and apply it to something that's 8 to 10 feet tall and weighs 1,000 pounds like a Sasquatch. You're talking about a very, very powerful animal. I mean, catching one is going to be nearly impossible. When they tranquilize large animals, when they dart them, like let's say in Africa, they usually do it from very close range because it's open plains there. It's all, you know, open savanna. So they do it from low-flying helicopters or from the tops of Jeeps or Land Rovers, and they get very close to them. You won't ever do that with a Sasquatch because they live in very dense vegetation and very strategic terrain. You know, they live in very steep, you know, pretty unforgiving areas that are nearly impossible to get in on foot, let alone get in on, you know, with a Jeep or a helicopter. And so then you think, okay, well, you're never going to get close enough to dart one from close range. Well, how are you going to get a shot at long range? You know, because they're going to constantly be in cover and be in this vegetation. And even if you did, you wouldn't know what kind of tranquilizer to use, and you wouldn't know how much of it to use. These things really depend on age and size and weight, and oftentimes the sex of the animal plays a factor. So let's say that you pulled all these off and you actually darted it. Well, now we don't know how long it'll take for the chemicals to deactivate this animal. This animal may run 5 miles away before it, you know, falls asleep. Or it may die, and we'll never find it. It may run 5 miles away and die, and you'll spend the next, you know, however long searching for the body. So just the logistics. No scientific organization, with what we know right now, like, again, hypothesize, we prove Sasquatches to be real. You come to them with what little we know. I mean, we know a lot about them, but it's still not enough for an organization to say, okay, well, let's go try to trank one now, because the logistics just aren't there. We don't know how to do it. So, again, they're not going to be located, followed, or subdued very easily, and that's why it's going to take so long to learn about them.
Uh-huh. Now, I know before when we talked, you had talked about a game camera that had picked up a juvenile going down
yes.
a path. Have game cameras picked up any more footage?
There have been some. There's always going to be kind of weird, anomalous, interesting images on game cameras, but nothing has been brought in nearly as compelling as those. I mean, those are they're incredible. Now, there were some good pictures. I say good, and they're good to Bigfoot researchers. They're still very blurry, but there were some pictures taken in Washington from a camera phone, a cell phone with a camera accessory that are on our website. I believe they were from Mason County, Washington, if I'm not mistaken. You should be able to find them on BFRO.net. But again, you know, people very often will bring in images, and people will catch fleeting glimpses, and sometimes if they're lucky, those glimpses will be accompanied by images. But nothing has been brought in since then as compelling as those photos. And we refer to them as the Jacobs photos because the man, Rick Jacobs, whose game camera that was. But again, that was, if you look into the lifestyle of the Sasquatch and their behaviors, yeah, that was kind of an atypical behavior for a Sasquatch. And we think that's because it was a young one, and it will be the young one who will make the mistakes. They're not, you know, the seasoned veterans of stealth and elusiveness. And very often, I mean, people see very young ones quite often. So not all Sasquatch reports are of the 8 to 10 foot, you know, variety.
Uh-huh.
And, but no, to answer your question, we haven't seen anything like that since then. No, that was last September when we got those.
Uh-huh, okay. Yeah, because the game cameras to me sound like a wonderful idea, you know. You would stand a much better chance. But, you know, then again, I don't have a lot of familiarity with that particular technology. You know, is there like an LED light that lights up or, you know, how do they
work?
There's a lot of
factors there. I mean, yeah, some of them have a flash that's like a regular camera flash. It's so bright, it's blinding. And they'll often go off whenever the wind blows and it moves anything in the foreground view of the camera. And so that thing will flash. And, you know, anything like a Sasquatch that's around that sees that wouldn't go near there because it's something foreign in their environment. It's something related. They would know that it would be related to humans. The bigger deal, though, is this. Let's say if you're in an area the size of, you know, the city limits of Seattle, for example, in the National Forest. There may only be 3 to 6 Sasquatches in that entire area.
Uh-huh.
And there's one of you, you know, with your game camera that you're putting up on the weekend, you know, for 4 or 5 nights at a time, you know, in a long stretch. So the odds, you know, you're talking about the odds factors, the odds of in a huge area of landmass and one game camera of this animal being there in the same place, same time to walk by and to have its picture taken, that's the major factor. Now, that's all, you know, speculative numbers because each piece of land in America is going to house different populations or none at all of Sasquatch. For example, I mean, there's many, many more of them in the state of Washington than there are in the state of Georgia. But still, you know, you have to play those odds and think, well, what are really even the odds? I know they're out here. I know they exist. But if I put this camera up in this one place, what are the odds that one will actually walk by here? So we're still figuring out those things, keep trying to narrow down those odds. Because a lot of it right now, people are still having to rely on luck. Even if you take an area, your study area, and you learn everything you can learn about it, you know, you learn every game trail and all the old abandoned logging roads and forest roads and the fire breaks and where the deer hang out and where the elk hang out and where the bear sign is most abundant, which kind of clay deposits can be found here, where these certain types of berries grow. I mean, there's so much information you factor in. Even when you've figured all that out, and you're trying to locate a Sasquatch, well, you've narrowed down your reliance on luck, and now you're relying on, you know, 60% of this hard work that you've done. But still, the other 40%, well, is there going to be a Sasquatch that comes around here tonight and comes within view of my video camera or my audio recorder or steps somewhere that I can find tracks before I have to leave, you know, in the next 2 days? So you're still, there's a lot of reliance on luck because we just haven't narrowed it down close enough yet, but we're getting better and better at it all the time. So those are factors that people think about too when they think about the game cam equations and all these things. Like, yes, we do have this technology, but it's not being used and focused and not in a huge collective effort will take, you know. The BFRO, those of us in the organization, we're the only people doing this stuff. You know, and there are other independent Bigfoot researchers out there, but for the most part, I mean, we're really doing this collective hard effort. And the information and the data and the evidence is coming a lot faster now than it used to. But it's still, I mean, it's a battle. It's a challenge. And it's in no way, shape, or form easy.
Well, it sounds like, you know, the BFRO is probably, you know, like the biggest organization involved in this in a serious way.
In a lot of ways, we're the only organization. And there are other groups and organizations, and that's not to knock anyone, but because I know there are other groups of people out there who are committed and devoted and who get together and work together, but there's no effort as large as the BFRO. I mean, we're the largest organization, the oldest and the only organization of its kind, and it's a labor of love. I think I said that before when I was on here. It's st- still basically an all-volunteer group. So there's a very
big learning curve.
You're
earning money chasing Bigfoot, right?
I don't know. Like you said before, I mean, it's all... I mean, luckily, we have a benefactor for the organization that helps funding when it comes to things like equipment. But, no, I don't earn any money doing this, and I don't intend to. You know, I'd rather help get them in our encyclopedias. You know, that I'd much rather be a part of the collective effort, which is what it's going to take. That means much more than any kind of, monetary gain. Because, again, we won't, even if they're proven real tomorrow, it's not like people are going to go, oh, well, these guys said that they were real this entire time, and these guys really put all this forth. Well, game over. Absolutely, it's not going to happen like that. What will happen is that, you know, we'll prove that somehow, like, let's use this situation in Georgia. If there was a dead Sasquatch found in Georgia, wouldn't the scientific community would say, okay, well, now we know there was at least one in Georgia. They're not going to say, you know, yes, we fully accept the existence of these animals ubiquitously across the continent. You know, so we'll still have to prove that they exist in other areas and which areas they do exist and find evidence. And then people will be so fascinated with these animals that there'll be this huge demand for knowledge of them. But again, that knowledge isn't going to come any easier than it has in the past. It's going to come very slowly and in fragments as we learn about them. And so, like I said, you know, because we're not going to be able to follow them very easily and locate them very easily. So once they're proven to be real for us, that's when the game will start. You know, that'll be just the beginning of this. But right now we're trying to, you know, feverishly to get to that point to get recognition and acceptance for this animal and to get some protection for them. Is another huge goal of the BFRO, and then from then, you know, to study them even more. But no, it's a difficult.
It's easy to imagine some less than well-educated person out and happens to spot Bigfoot and blast away with his deer rifle or shotgun or whatever, and manages to kill one. I mean, unfortunately, that's the scenario that I can see happening. Much easier than I can, you know, finding one
at night in their crosshairs before. I mean, there have been sightings reported where hunters have seen them in their crosshairs. And so, I mean, some hunters have shot. I mean, there's a lot of stories of them being shot at or, you know, oftentimes being hit. But for the most part, people say the sightings so brief that they were so stunned by what they were seeing. Sometimes people will say, well, it looked too human-like. Or sometimes people will say, I thought there was a possibility that it might be some kind of a person. But I mean that may happen one day, but I'm just throwing that out there to let you know that that's been reported before in many legitimate encounters and reports. So you know people have had them in their sights before, and I'm sure they will again. And who knows? Maybe after a story like this that just happened, where America was kind of presented with the idea that one had been killed, maybe people will react different. Maybe it has some effect on the way people perceive situations like that. I don't know. I mean, only time will tell that. But, you know, it's certainly not impossible. But that's not, you know, we're not out trying to kill one. That's not what we're interested in. We're interested in getting very, very good, powerful video footage of
right.
them and to collect DNA.
I did have a question in text in the virtual auditorium. Let me get to it again. Do sightings occur mostly near caves, streams, a certain type of landmark? You know, what kind of terrain?
Wooded terrain would be the only common denominator. I mean, because they exist in areas of the Everglades of Florida, and they exist in areas of the Rocky Mountains. They exist in areas of the rainforest of the Pacific Northwest. They exist in areas, you know, the upper New York State, the Adirondack Mountains. So there's no commonality besides, you know, remote, wooded, you know, yes, I mean, there's always creeks and streams and rivers. And, for example, in northeast Georgia, there are no caves. I mean, that's just a landform that doesn't exist out there. In the northwestern part of the state, there are many caves, but in northeast Georgia, there are not caves. There may be a few small overhangs, but now there are some old gold mines, but certainly not enough to say that there's a lot of gold mines and mine shafts around, but they don't need caves to hide in or survive in. It certainly wouldn't hurt, and they probably would be attracted to landforms like that. But no, I mean, there's no pattern there. Like, if we've had areas where there have been numerous tracks found or numerous sightings, you would think, well, all you have to do is find the nearest cave and then hang out around there and hopefully see the Sasquatch. And it just doesn't work that way. They don't stay in those areas long enough. They move around in their home ranges. They don't migrate. They don't migrate from, and at least in my opinion, they don't migrate from place to place. But they will have a large area that a family group would live in, you know, a pretty large area that they would move around in. And so it's almost impossible to kind of predict where they'll be in that area at any given time, or that there will be any place that you could reliably come to expect one to be. If they lived a lifestyle like that, we would have found them by now, but they don't. You know, they're nomadic enough to where you can't locate them that way.
That's interesting. To try and imagine a hominid that uses no tools for hunting or anything else, doesn't have fire, doesn't need clothing, doesn't need shelter, and doesn't even make nests. I mean, this is kind of mind-boggling. And then add in the incredibly nomadic nature, I'm amazed anybody's ever seen one.
Well, people see them quite often. I mean, several hundred sightings a year that come to us that we feel are legitimate. There are probably many, many more sightings than that just never get reported. But more often than that, people will hear them, or they'll hear them moving in the brush, or they'll have some kind of interaction, like, you know, some kind of rock-throwing incident or various things like that. Most people don't see them. And that's another thing that contributes to their success, is that in areas that have a lot of Sasquatch activity, I will get so many reports from people who say there are no such thing as Sasquatches, and then I'll say, well, tell me the strangest thing that's ever happened to you in the woods. And they'll tell me a story that is to a T, you know, a Sasquatch encounter, but they never saw it. It stalked them, it followed them, it threw rocks at them, it screamed at them, it shook vegetation and crashed down some trees, and the things that Sasquatches do to intimidate people to get them to leave. But because the person never saw the animal, and in their mind or their reality box, however you want to put it, you know, they don't factor Sasquatches into that. They think, well, those things aren't real, so it had to have been something else. Now, if they had seen it, it would have changed their mind, because then they would have known what they were looking at. And so I think, you know, more people see them than we know, because they won't all get reported to organizations like ours. But beyond that, many, many, many more people hear them, hear their vocalizations, or et cetera, and that never gets reported, because a lot of these people write those events off as, you know, something else, or just something anomalous. So many people tell me an interesting story that to me is indicative of Sasquatch behavior, and then they'll say, you know, I've always wondered what that was. And they've just left it at that in their mind. They've never put, you know, a face or a name to this experience, and they've just said, huh, that was weird. I never knew what that was. And so there are quite a lot of people that experience these things. I mean, they're really not.
What kind of noises does Bigfoot make?
I mean, that would be a huge answer. I mean, they'll make various types of sounds vocally, for example. I mean, they make a strange kind of array of sounds vocally and non-vocally, you know, making things together and certain things like that, et cetera. But vocally, they'll make an array of sounds really depending on their range to each other, their distance to each other. At great distances from each other, they emit these very eerie, kind of mournful howls and screams. And it's just because the volume and pitch that they're putting out there really carries a long distance. And so it's you know, many animals vocalize in that manner to locate each other. Sasquatches will do the same thing. Closer range, however, they'll make more unique sounds. You know, if you say like mid-range sounds, they'll make strange whooping sounds like you'll hear on the BFRO's website. I've heard that in the field a few times. And then very close to each other, I mean, we've heard things that had recordings of things that had witnesses report sounds that sound very much like people talking to each other. Theirs is a very kind of growly, it's very hard to describe, but it's reminiscent of people talking to each other, which is very strange. That's not to say that they have a language. It may be just, you know, some kind of chatter like other apes will chatter, or it may be something very proto-lingual, but they will make those sounds, and that's an unnerving thing to hear, and people very often will hear those things too, witnesses, and people on our expeditions as well. And there are recordings, there are MP3 examples of that on our website. There's a photo, videos, and sound section of BFR.net that has some examples of those sounds, but you wouldn't be able to categorize, you know, here are the sounds that Sasquatches make, because they have complex vocal tracts, probably very similar to ours, and so they can make a variety of sounds. They'll make very interesting whistling sounds very often. And again, if I had to classify it, I would say that you'd have to distinguish it by their distance to or from each other.
Okay. So there's sounds not unlike sounds that humans would make.
Well, the defining factors, like when a Sasquatch does these big, powerful howls, it's of a pitch that's just almost unearthly. When you hear it, you know it's no other animal, and you just can't conceive a human making that sound. And I've met a lot of people who have tried to emulate it. But beyond that, they'll just sustain the amount of lung capacity that they have. They'll produce a call with such sustain, and a call that'll be so drawn out that they'll just go on for much longer than a human can do, or a coyote can do, or a wolf can do. And it's just, those are the kind of defining factors when you think it's a very, very big animal with a very powerful set of lungs, that's a set of lungs much bigger than anything that we know of. So they're human-like only in a very superficial sense. I mean, they're very powerful sounds, and people
now have the researchers played these sounds that they've recorded back when they're out in the field to see if they get a responding call?
Absolutely. We've done that. I know the BFRO has done that for many years, and have gotten a lot of responses that way. The expedition that yielded the Skookum cast, that expedition, there was a lot of, we call it call blasting, you know, blasting their calls out into the night and getting responses, trying to get approaches, et cetera. With that particular expedition, there was a lot of call blasting going on, and then, you know, the animal approached and took up a position around a bait pile and laid down and left this beautiful impression there in the mud that was cast. You know, the Skookum cast is another thing. You could devote any one of these two-hour shows to just the Skookum cast, or just the Patterson film, or just recorded vocalizations of Sasquatches if you wanted to. There's so much information there, it's really hard to summarize. But to answer Chris, yes, we've done that, and it's yielded results in the field before, so that's a useful technique.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, yeah, because you wonder, you know, because I'm sure anyone who spent much time in a remote area has heard some strange sounds in the night.
Absolutely.
And you wonder, okay, you know, was I really hearing something being tortured by something else?
Well, something that's important to do is to really intimately familiarize yourself with the native sounds that are like, when I was doing field research in North Georgia, I had to really get familiar with all the sounds of the indigenous animals there. And I'll tell you, there's some animals that make some very bizarre sounds, like barred owls have very interesting, when they have a territorial dispute, they will make sounds that sound very much like monkeys chattering. They don't sound like big, you know, they don't sound large like Sasquatches do, but that it's reminiscent of the way monkeys sound when they are chattering. And, you know, I was very familiar with them as I first got into research. I knew that I had to familiarize myself with all these different sounds so that I knew what I was listening to when I was in the field. That way, if I heard something that wasn't anything I was familiar with, it was a good starting point. But I've been out in the field with people who, not Bigfoot researchers, but, you know, friends of mine who I've taken into the field and had some barred owls start up a territory dispute, and my friends were just sure that they were hearing some kind of monkeys. And I'll say, no, those are owls. But, you know, if you were a novice and you weren't familiar with that, it probably would be very unnerving to hear that. So, you know, you're right, there are a lot of weird sounds in the woods that aren't Bigfoot. I mean, Sasquatches are the weirdest, but there's a lot of other things that make some very strange sounds. small, like red foxes, for example. Foxes make some very kind of haunting sounding cries and screams. And they sound almost like a child. They're only very superficially in the pitch, but just a piercing kind of scream. And if you didn't know it was a fox, you'd be really trying to figure out, you'd wonder for a long time what it was that you were hearing.
One time, and I was out with several others, so several of us heard it, this scream sounded like a cross between, I guess, a gorilla and a horse being slowly tortured. And the scream seemed to go on forever. And it sounded like something was being horribly tortured. And I don't know what it was. It wasn't an animal any of us had ever heard before or since. But it was the most bizarre sound. And it did. It went on for, it seemed like an eternity.
That's pretty bizarre. I've never heard of that.
I don't know what it was, but, you know, like I said,
it sounded like a scream. Describe now. Yeah, I mean, scream, you say, you know, like a gorilla and a horse, that's, another person might hear the same thing and describe it, you know, use different descriptors to
It was a very big-sounding scream. It didn't sound like it came from a small animal. That's the best way I can put it. And it sounded like it was, even though it was fairly loud, like it was coming over some distance. And there again, you're sort of guessing, you know. But
well, it may very well have been a Sasquatch. You never know.
Yeah, maybe. We are out of time. And
it always goes very, very fast.
Yeah, it does. Folks, I have enjoyed tonight's program immensely as we explored a topic that's as interesting and much more so than chasing monsters in the dark. I hope it's provided you with something to think about. Tune in again next week for another fascinating program. And with that, it's time for me to go. So I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night. You still there, Matt?
Yes.
Well, thank you very much. I guess I'm going to have to bring you on and do some more talking about it.
Oh, I can't thank you enough for having me on again. And I know this, again, there really is a lot of information there. So any questions, I kind of, my mind starts racing of how I'm going to answer this in the most direct way. So I don't mean to rant so much.
Oh, no, you did fine. You did fine. I'll send you a link with exactly where the archives are located.
Excellent.
And thank you very much for coming on.
Definitely. Well, I appreciate it very much again. Thank you.
I guess we're going to get blasted by the radio.
Yeah, I can barely get it.
Anyhow, I will talk to you soon. I'll send you off that email later tonight. Okay?
Thank you. Have a good one.
You too. Good night.